Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 30, where we are discussing a JMS Classic article by Hugh Wilmot entitled Strength is Ignorance, Slavery is Freedom, Managing Culture in Modern Organizations. To get the text and for more information, both about this episode and about our Journal of Management Studies season, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
And I'm Joe, coming to you from Melbourne, Florida.
And I'm Yusuf, coming to you from Dubai, UAE.
Wonderful. Welcome, everybody, to the final episode of season 3. Hey!
What a deal.
How exciting is this?
Yes.
This is the final JMS Classic that we're discussing, and it's been an interesting journey. I think you'll agree. We're happy that we did it. Certainly spoke to lots of interesting people that probably wouldn't have spoken to otherwise, and we've read many foundational works in management, and that was great. So, this episode is not only significant in that it's the final one of season 3, we're also debuting Yusuf, our social media person and a fellow podcaster.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm really excited to be on this episode finally. So thanks a lot for giving me this opportunity.
Oh, we're so excited to have you. If you've been interacting with us on Twitter and Facebook and you saw the anniversary series, for example, that's all Yusuf. That's all his work. So he's really been, since he took over, he's been amazing. We're not going to do a big introduction for this episode because, uncharacteristically, we released a supplement episode last week, which outlines the discussion and outlines the context of the debate. But for just a quick recap of what it is that we're going to talk about, does anyone want to go ahead and give a few words about Wilmot and his work and maybe critical management studies?
So in Hugh Wilmot's paper published 24 years ago in 1993, he critically examines what he named corporate culturalism, which is a theory of management that sees culture as an instrument of competitive advantage. So in essence, it considers culture as the main determinant of organizational performance and excellence. It is distinct from, but similar to, human resource management and total quality management, in relation to the importance it places on culture. So at the time, Wilmot identified an absence of critical writing on corporate culturalism. So what he focuses on in this paper is the dark side of this project by drawing attention to what he considers its totalitarian implications. What distinguishes corporate culturalism from other types of management, or what is unique about it, is that in order to strengthen corporate culture, its practitioners are not only concerned with managing employee behavior, but also with managing employees' beliefs and thoughts. What this means is that workers are not only expected to do their jobs, but also expected to personally identify with the values of the company they work for. And in corporate culturalism, organizations attempt to systematize this process. So in addition to arguments grounded on organization scholarship, Wilmot analyzes the world and characters of 1984, George Orwell's widely read dystopian novel. Wilmot reads 1984 as a metaphor for corporate culturalism's philosophy of control. He shows how concepts from 1984, such as doublethink, are helpful in illuminating its insidious tendencies. Behind its veneer of autonomy and freedom, Wilmot argues, is a kind of meta-choice, or predetermined choice, that systematically constrains the very conditions required to struggle with alternative value standpoints and their life projects. We will also be discussing two commentaries that were published in the May 2013 edition of the Journal of Management Studies. One of them is an article by Peter Fleming called Down of Big Brother, the End of Corporate Culturalism, and the other is a response from Hugh Wilmot. Both papers offer important reflections on resistance and discuss emergent forms of corporate regulation, which for Peter Fleming inspire new forms of dissent. It is suggested that what we might call the cultural turn in management thrives on a widespread belief that there is no alternative. that we have arrived at the so-called end of history. But if we pay attention to our present moment, to the social and political constellation that we find ourselves in today, it seems that capitalist realism is itself in crisis. Does our time, characterized by widespread anti-establishment sentiment, possibly open to alternatives, signal the end of corporate culturalism? And if it does, how should we read Wilmot's JMS classic today? What is certain and faithful to the spirit of these papers, and possibly to the spirit of critical management studies, which is maybe the first time we're engaging with it directly on this podcast, is that keeping things open rather than closed nurtures thought. So I really look forward to this discussion.
Yeah, and thank you for that. There's definitely a lot to unpack in this paper. I mean, we have almost step-by-step progression of thinking about corporate culturalism from it being considered as a panacea to all management issues and inconsistencies to coming back from a critical perspective and being considered as this really almost evil way of management, very, very insidious. And I think I, from my own reflections on how I came across this line of thought, is I've come full circle in much the same way as Yusuf just outlined, from thinking that, oh, this is a great way to resolve issues that come in hand with scientific management methods and more traditional direct overt control mechanisms, to reflecting and realizing that this is actually something very much that goes beyond where organizations and management should perhaps go. And I'm very curious to see what is Joe's experience, especially in coming from public sector and armed forces, is with regards to this as well. Do you have a preferred way how to go ahead and proceed with this?
So
I mean, we can go chronologically as well.
Yeah. Might be interesting because it sounds like we've each gone through the discovery. I originally was not signed up to be part of this session. And when I agreed to, I picked up the Wilmot 93 paper. And within just two or three pages, I've made a mistake. But let me take a look at the 2013 paper, and I noticed his comment on page 4, which reads that some readers might stop short at the title of these reflections on strength or break off at a point when they sense they're being drawn into disquieting critical terrain. At which point I realized that's exactly what had happened. And then said, oh, okay, so I must remain engaged to see where this story ends up. But we could return to the Wilmot first, if you'd like to. I do have some thoughts, but they're definitely contrasted with the later papers.
Well, we can begin by talking about what corporate culturalism is and why it came about. I guess I'll give it a go that corporate culturalism is pretty much an approach to management that considers culture as opposed to processes or systems or operations as the main mechanism by which organizations would be managed to achieve their goals. So the idea there is that instead of micromanaging or prescribing things for people to do, like thinking of Taylorism and scientific management, the idea is that people are reflective, intelligent agents, and they're not susceptible to direct management, but if we can make them believe in organizational goals and ideals, then they will go ahead and solve problems in creative and efficient ways because they want to contribute to the company. That's kind of the nutshell, I think, of this philosophy. There are some drawbacks and limitations that both Wilmot and Fleming very accurately point out through this 1984 metaphor. I think one of the primary ones is that corporate culturalism doesn't leave space for divergence and dissent. So it's a very monolithic, very unidirectional way of looking at culture, and it's a very instrumental way of looking at culture. Essentially, culture in this system is anything that can contribute to managerial outcomes as opposed to kind of culture as we normally think of it, as something emergent, something that people do through artifacts and traditions and so on and so forth. So it's both an approach that makes sense in a way that, okay, let's stop controlling individuals directly and just motivate them through subscription to ideals that we all hold as members of the organization. But at the same time, it pretty much also says that your ideals are valid only insofar as they comply with organizational ideals, which is this very dark, dystopian, anarcho-capitalistic kind of approach to people management.
It was interesting to read Wilmot's first paper, because I had really previously thought of culture as pretty much a good thing, with some examples. So in America, we have a chain called Nordstrom's, which I believe would probably be the same class as Marks and Spencer in England. It's basically a high-end department store where they've espoused that their frontline salespeople have considerable authority to make things right, that they don't offer them a lot of guidance on what that means. And so there have been stories over the years about, you know, a customer breaking a heel while on travel and the salesperson shipping them a replacement set of shoes to, you know, a dinner in Hong Kong or something like that. So that was where I was thinking. I hadn't really contemplated what happens if you take it steps further and drive out that divergence of opinion.
I mean, that's how it started, doesn't it? That's the beginning of it, that let's give people the opportunity to do things as they see fit and best suited. And as long as we can sort of align that with organizational goals and stuff like that, then that's absolutely great.
Demetrius, you had mentioned that there's an element of anarcho-capitalist.
Well, it was a bit of a swing, but yeah, I think there are.
Yeah. So I mean, if we put it in context, it would fit a certain idea of the restructuring of capital from Fordism to post-Fordism. In the paper, they do mention that the context in which corporate culturalism becomes appealing is during the 80s and 90s, when you have, let's say, one of the references, I believe, in Peter Fleming's paper is Boltanski and Schiapello's The New Spirit of Capitalism. For Boltanski and Schiapello, we can understand capitalism as, like, there were three spirits of capitalism. And so the first one that leads up to the 1930s is this sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And the second one, which is post-World War Fordist model.
Henry Ford recognized that in order to sell a lot of cars, he needed a lot of people with at least some modicum amount of money and having a standard of living that mm-hmm. would enable them to afford having the cars. So he was willing to double, which he did. He doubled the salaries of his employees.
Yeah.
Because he viewed that as creating then a class of people who would be able to buy his product.
That's a great point, yeah. They even had a scheme where they could contribute part salary towards a vehicle in the future.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so the corporate culturalism, I think, and it's kind of buried a little bit in both Wilmot and Fleming, is it provides a scheme that is more extractive, that results in the people at the top of the pyramid getting a lot higher fraction of the benefit of the business,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't ensure that they can go out and even be able to afford the products that they're making or selling. It's not uncommon in the American press to see, at least on a weekly basis, either in the Wall Street Journal or some of the other more investigative organizations, some industry like trucking, where they figured out that truckers are getting paid 67 cents an hour in some of the
wow.
some of the industries, you know, some of the businesses,
mm-hmm.
where clearly it's structured to look like a good deal, but it really turns out to be very, very painful for the people near the bottom of the pyramid. That culturalism is the tool that has been used in order to create those systems.
Right, because the sales pitch there is that maybe the salaries are a bit lower, or maybe the deal is a bit worse, but you get to have your identity and autonomy back on the face of it anyway. So it's directly tapping into, in this weird way, into the human resources tradition. So kind of to outline a brief evolution of this, we had the scientific management, which was followed by human resources school, starting with Hawthorne Studies by Elton Mayo, which is episode, I don't remember, at some point in the beginning. And then this seems to be tapping into that by saying that, okay, so there's going to be less management, and you can have your identity and you can have your personality back in the workplace. The only catch is, though, as Wilmot and Fleming identify, is that this personality and identity has to comply with what organizations and managers expect them to be. So it can't be yours. It can only be yours as long as it is also corporately mandated.
Right. And as you mentioned earlier on, a strong culture in a way would entail a lack of contamination by other ends or values.
Yeah, like there's this famous study of Disney called Smile Factory, where they went and studied the employees working at Disneyland, who number of whom turned out to be completely miserable, but they had to keep up an appearance of being happy and engaging with visitors, because that was the corporate identity. That's, I think, one of the very vivid examples of how corporate culturalism taken to the extreme in neglect of personality and human and humanity is actually a very, very severe thing, perhaps even worse than on an individual employee than scientific management, or not much different anyway. And I mean, the whole idea of emotional labor also feeds directly into this, that we'll have an episode on this coming up in the next season. I think primarily defined by the book The Managed Heart, and there we'll be discussing, I'm sure, these issues that go with making this emotional facade to comply with what is expected of you as an employee by the organization. But there is much more to it, and kind of the Wilmot articles really, and the Fleming ones, they keep drawing parallels with the George Orwell's 1984, which it's been a while since I read, to be honest. But the one of the primary themes of 1984 was not necessarily this culturalism, but surveillance and kind of futility of resistance in many ways. And I think that's one of the key turning points in all of these three papers that Wilmot and Fleming are hedging their discussion against, albeit from different perspectives, and it being that surveillance of whether culture is being upheld in the ways that are compliant with organizational mandates, and then if it isn't, then corrective actions taken by organizations to ensure that it has to be. And that's an interesting thing to do, and I'm very curious about Joe's experience in the military with regards to this, because it seems like that would be a comparable setting where you ought to display certain cultural characteristics, maybe, and where at least where certain other kind of more maybe on the face of it negative cultural artifacts are not tolerated.
Yes, so anticipated we get there. The so I classify it as you have the. Because the military is such a large organization and there are sub-organizations within it, you have a wide range of possible situations. I think in the best, where you reap the benefits of this is where you have a lot of the tenets of culturalism, but they haven't gone to the extreme. They allow divergence. So if you recall, we discussed high reliability organizations in an earlier podcast. And one of the features of a high reliability organization is the ability to have the conversations about potential problems before they actually become a significant problem for the organization. But yet there are units where that is not permitted. And those are the units that tend to get themselves into trouble. I think it's an extension of this where you get to the monoclonal, organization becomes susceptible to problems, which could collapse it. The commanding officer could get relieved. So you see it in the military, but it's such a wide spectrum that it would not be desired to be in the part of the spectrum where you suffer the ill effects, let's put it that way, of culturalism.
Right. And how do they sort of work to keep this myopia of sorts out of the workplace? Because I mean, it can be very easy to just go with the group thing and avoid having this dialogue or not having the space for discussion that you mentioned.
A lot of it comes with how we try to train our leaders. So I come out of the submarine force, and basically you have three opportunities every day for the senior leaders, the officers, to converse in a setting that is both formal and informal, and it's the meals. You also have a lot of the other functions where you go have the opportunity to interact with senior officers. So those who are conscious of these ideas are using those settings to try to teach the ones who are coming up behind them, and then eventually guys like me who become senior officers, we're trying to teach the next generation of that. And also not have a situation where what they say is different than what they do. And so you're trying to live the same principles as you're discussing. In the better commands, that you can see that run through a hierarchy. In others, that breaks down at some point because, as in 1984, you have people who say all the right words but think something different. That would be Julia, right?
Yeah.
And so at some point they become responsible and they have a level of authority that they believe allows them to do something different than what they've said they were going to do all the way up until they got to that point. And that's when things get out of hand, so to speak. The other, though, is sometimes whole organizations adopt over a period of time a set of values that are inimical to the organization. And some might say the U.S. Air Force is there right now. It's open source, a lot of online discussions about the leadership of the Air Force and how they promote people, and the belief amongst a fair fraction of people that they've got a large number of leaders at the top who have the wrong value system. They're definitely corporate culturalism gone bad.
Oh, it's very interesting. So when you say the wrong values, I think it's important to point out that with an organization like that, there is an expected set of values, so that there's a purpose to which these organizations exist, and I guess you can see clearer from the outside when these diverge from what is actually happening. I mean, this is of course not so necessarily in commercial organizations like the ones Wilmot's talking about. Like for example, how would we know? Well, actually, no, this is an interesting question. So, if we take Facebook, for example, as a company, how do we know what is the, when this situation might be presenting itself, that when the corporate values and sort of the good or the, right societally, say, expected values diverge. And I mean, and I was thinking about, as I was saying this, about the whole data protection stuff that was happening. And yeah, I guess you can actually anticipate when values of senior management might not be aligned with kind of expected values or something like that. But of course, we don't. That doesn't really tell us much about corporate culturalism and what's going on, with the exception of whether people are going along with the party line, as it were, and to continue with the 1984 theme, or whether there is an ability and the space that Joe mentioned to engage in dialogue and critically evaluate and reflect upon what people are doing.
Especially if the organization has some public presence, and that's hard not to these days. It's relatively easy, in my view, to see problems within organizations. So let's take a different one that's been in the press recently, Uber. Uber's current situation, actually, if you look back, probably about 3 or 4 years ago, you could have predicted that we would get to where we are right now. From just the few interactions in the press at the time with drivers, the disorganization on rate structure, some of the crimes that occurred because of drivers not being screened, and the company answer that these were isolated cases, not endemic. When I hear that phrase, I almost always know that the company is lying. Because if it's more than 3 or 4, it's endemic. If it's already made it to the press. So I think it's relatively easy to see organizations that have these kinds of problems if you're an outsider.
Really happy you brought Uber into this, because we'll be this theme of management by algorithms and stuff is going to be coming through more in the near future. But do you think it was a case of lying necessarily? And I mean, we're speculating here at this point, but it could also be just a case of complete ignorance of what culture is, as opposed to, you know, what they thought culture was. If it's this kind of corporate culturalism expose.
You are correct. It might not have been lying. It might have been purposeful ignorance.
Yeah. It's just literally being ignorant of what the company is in favor of what you want it to be.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the issues with corporate culturalism, isn't it? It doesn't give space for critical conversation about what might be the other cultures. It doesn't even have space within it for other cultures. It's this monolithic, everyone marching to the same tune kind of thing.
Yes. But so I guess my take would be that if you're are open to seeing, you can see these situations pretty quickly. And then it becomes, what do you do about it? Because a lot of people don't know what to do about it. Therefore, they don't want to see it, because they'll be confronted with, they have to do something, but they don't know what to do.
Ah, that's a lovely take on that. It kind of reflects on what Wilma wrote as well in the original paper, that that he identified one of the dimensions of critical approach to corporate culturalism is has to do with its content and practical implications.
Mm-hmm.
And one of that was the critical analysis of real world applications. And I think that might have to do directly with what you just said.
So in his original paper, he made reference to Smerchich, and you know, she's an ethologist, basically, an anthropologist. A lot of good papers, by the way.
Yeah, and a lot of work on culture specifically.
Yes, but her comments on value, you know, the axiological perspective that people have tended to ignore, probably because they're pretty challenging. That's something that Wilmot highlighted specifically. Get to it. I think that's what Wilmot's disquietude with the corporate culturalism is because it's founded on a set of values he could not ascribe to, or thinks and or also thinks should not be, and that probably pushed him to this line of research and work because of his disquietude with the set of values that clearly creates corporate culturalism.
Yeah, and I think he ascribes some of those values to the broader societal tendencies and what he terms here on page 519 as a potent mixture of neoliberalism and nationalism, or at least ascribing that to the situation in the US and Britain at the time. And I mean, a lot of that has to do with corporations and organizations promoting this culturalist agenda in order to demand almost perfect loyalty from them, from their employees. And of course, loyalty in this and this understanding, especially I think this has to do with the nationalist echoes, has no space for disagreement. So loyal actually means a yes man in many ways, but whether that is actually the case or, as the case with Julia in 1984, just a show, really. And that leads me, in a way, to come back to what you mentioned initially about the role of leadership in corporate culturalism. Because if we get down to it, these cultures that exist in this way and are perpetuated, or in the case with Uber, possibly imagined, they are not collectively built, you know? I think usually the case is that they stem from a very limited collection of sources, and in many cases from an individual heroic founder, this, you know, mythological figure that established this multi-billion dollar organization, and now everyone there has to follow the values, you know, this almost archetypical Silicon Valley wunderkind who went there, saw, conquered, and now the organization is almost an extension of that personality, because that personality, however real or fictional, is kind of seen as a model of success. And we are seeing a lot of that, I think, now. There's even that show, Silicon Valley. Do you know of it?
I heard of it, but I never watched it, no.
Yeah, neither have I, unfortunately, I guess.
Yeah, well, neither have I, so I guess it's a bit odd to use this as an example. But I know some of it. I like a number of comedians that are on it, and it seems to be sort of at least indirectly espousing this idea of culture stemming from this one semi-fictional figure, you know, the founder. And then, of course, when it goes sideways on account of the employee, then, you know, there's very direct punishment and stuff like that. So I guess a lot of this reference to leadership does have to do with motivations and maybe lack of understanding of organizational science and studies on behalf of those people who design these organizations, because just think of how odd it is to say that because I am the founder, everyone working for me has to share in my values and ideals and even kind of these projected experiences. And those who do not have no place here. I mean, that's the definition of myopia, basically. And that's a lot of what Wilmot and Fleming have an issue with. But the bigger issue they have is this process of control and punishment that goes along with maintaining these corporate cultures. And there's been a fair few ethnographies, including one by Gideon Kunde called Engineering Culture, that showed kind of the dark side of this relentless culturalism and how people burn out and how people really struggle to get on with their work because of this additional sideshow that they have to put on in order to please and appease management so that they can work. And that for Wilmot seems very counterintuitive and very odd, as well as borderline sinister.
I guess what's for me, what I saw as one of the takeaways from the paper, focusing on its sinister, let's say, aspect, is I read Wilmot as analyzing a newly emerging way of legitimizing the, let's say, capitalist political economy of that time. He argues that as part of modernity, he uses the term modernity, but I guess other writers have preferred to use the term postmodernism, right? where the individualizing impact of these modernizing forces relativize meaning and demystify authority. And corporate culturalism comes in this context, to provide a sense of identity and security, as, you know, you mentioned earlier on. And I guess this fits with the whole Silicon Valley startup entrepreneurship culture. So the way I would understand the demystification of authority would be that corporate culturalism presents itself as providing people with, or presents the workplace itself as a space for self-actualization. And so resisting that becomes a lot more difficult, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because the workplace sort of shifts from this thing that you have to do punching the clock to a place where the employer, and I think Google is a good example of this, kind of is providing you with all the means of leisure and mental stimulation. And if you resist that, then it's essentially a question of what's wrong with you. I think in many ways there's a strong normative and kind of judgmental element to resisting corporate culturalism when it's so overtly friendly and overtly colorful and great place to work and so on and so forth.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Google in particular. I guess they have this idea of 20% time. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah. 3M has a similar system. So essentially it's that 20%, or I think in the case of 3M, like 10% of work time that employees have to put in for their salary should be used. It must be used indeed on things that have nothing to do with the direct employment of these people. So the idea is that people would use this time to go and be creative and use company resources to experiment and try things out, and that could lead to innovation.
Right, and I had read another paper that was taking a critical perspective on Google's 20% time. I don't remember the name of the paper at the moment, but in it they were saying that Google presents this option of 20% time as giving workers the time and the resources to work on their own terms, to do whatever they feel like, but in fact, at the end of the day, workers ended up working more, completing the tasks that they had to do in the time allotted to them to do that work. And a lot of the times, the additional work that was not part of their, let's say, responsibilities would go towards work that benefits Google itself. So it's presented as a time of freedom, but in fact, it helps the organization achieve their ends at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we keep coming back to, that is sort of this one of two main issues with this approach to management, is that if you wanted to, in your 20% or 10% time or whatever, to go and just hang out with your family, that that doesn't count. You know, that wouldn't count as using that time. That would be count as notified absence or whatever. So it's not really that, okay, here is a chunk of time of your day, of your resources that you sell as part of employment. You go and do whatever you want to with it. It's more that here, go and make something else for us. And that's the issue with this hypocrisy that's going on with corporate culturalism as identified by Wilmot and Fleming. But I don't want to come across as this complete cynic about corporate culturalism, because, you know, these are, I think, relatively extreme examples. And, you know, we see Google and Facebook as these places where the ultimate goal is almost to ensure that employees live there. You know, they provide lodging, they provide food, recreation. And then essentially it's this dystopian switcheroo where you trade in all of your life for working at Google. So you live there, or any other comparable organization. You live there, you eat there, all your friends are fellow employees. So essentially get fully absorbed by the company. You adopt their values, you adopt their language, which is important. Hence the metaphor with all those doublethink parts of 1984. But I mean, that's an extreme case, and we don't see that all that much. Corporate culturism, I think, certainly has advantages when done maybe more reflectively. As Joe mentioned, high reliability organizing has an element of corporate culturalism, but it's very different. We had a number of episodes on high reliability management, and the thing there is that common values that everyone must have to do with these objectively beneficial non-company specific issues like safety and reflexivity and you know, whatever else. These more extreme cases, of course, push more on these more subjective values that have to do with even the personalities of founders and CEOs and that kind of stuff. So there is certainly a positive aspect to this, and I wouldn't want to dismiss it as just brainwashing, which I think we might come across as sounding like. Yeah, culture is in many ways, or if not culture engineering, then culture nudging is certainly a valid way of managing a workforce. Joe's example from the military certainly, I think, contributes to this. I'm sure there are many examples from smaller companies where, you know, culture is shaped around maybe values such as safety or, well, great customer service is a more questionable one. You know, you have the smile charts in McDonald's and so on and so forth. But yeah, I think it's important to give a balanced view, and it's not all 1984 insofar as culture is concerned. And that's all for part 1 of episode 30. Thank you so much for listening. We want to apologize for the delay in releasing this episode, and that there's a gap between the supplement that was released and now the actual episode. This is partly because of the scheduling issues that we were first supposed to have a guest here, but we couldn't quite arrange a time. And also partly because I was moving, and that basically put a halt on all podcast and audio editing activities for a while. Now, we do have a couple of episodes in the bank that we're going to release after episode 30, and then we're probably going to have a bit of a break before going on to season 4. But rest assured that from this point onwards, there should be a smooth release schedule as before. We're also going to announce winner of Mats Alvesen's book shortly, and just very exciting times coming ahead for the podcast. So next week we're going to continue to discuss corporate culturalism and Hugh Willmott's classic, focusing on language and technology in particular, here on Talking About Organizations.